Welcome to Recovering Evangelicals, a podcast for people who were once very comfortable in the Christian faith until the 21st century intruded and made it very hard to keep on believing. I'm your host, Luke Jansen.
And I'm Scott Dyer.
We regularly get quite a few questions and suggestions for episode ideas from our listeners, far too many for us to act on all of them. Often those ideas or questions get incorporated into a larger episode theme that we're developing. But in a few cases, those suggestions or questions develop into a whole episode of its own. Today's episode will be one of the latter. One of our longtime listeners brought a certain online video to our attention earlier this week. Rennie, who grew up in Christianity but has for several decades been on a deconstruction journey through that, she sent me a link to a conversation between the infamous Richard Dawkins and a relatively newer name, Ayaan Hirsi Ali. In her email, after some personal comments, Rennie wrote, "This Christian and atheist interview had a unique tone and perspective in content material. Much of what Ayaan said resonates with me. However, Richard Dawkins again brings some uncomfortable questions that Ayaan will be dealing with in her newfound faith in God or Jesus or Christianity, the same ones I have had. Ayaan brings up important issues that we in our post-Christian Western culture seems to have inadequate answers for. Curious as to your thoughts, Luke, about this video conversation between Ayaan and Richard Dawkins. I hope there will be a follow-up conversation with the two of them. I watched that video, and yes, there is a lot to chew on in there. And after watching it a second time, this time with pen and paper in hand to take some rough notes, I thought I needed to make this an episode for the podcast for all of our listeners, rather than a personal reply just to Rennie. And let me say to the listeners, if you haven't yet seen this video, I'd recommend you do so before you listen to us talk about it. You're just not going to get as much out of this episode if you don't hear Richard and Ayaan themselves making the claims. You can search on YouTube for the terms God Debate, Richard Dawkins, and Ayaan Hirsi Ali. Ayaan is spelled A-Y-A-A-N. Or go to our show notes. We've got a link in there. It's really going to make a difference for if you do or don't listen to Richard and Ayaan. So seriously, stop the episode right here and watch that video first, then pick up again here where you left off. I also thought that we needed to bring on at least one other person to represent the atheist side of this argument. We obviously couldn't get Richard Dawkins on such short notice, so we reached out to a longtime listener, Doug Traversa. He's been on our podcast several times. I've had certain excerpts and quotes from him, but we've also done two episodes with him. Well, one was exclusively with him, and one was with three other atheists. We described in detail in that episode, and I'll have a link for that in the show notes. We described in detail Doug's story. I really recommend you listen to it. It's a fascinating story. But in 1 minute, a thumbnail sketch, basically he has decades of experience in a fundamentalist background, but then he found he needed to explore a few other religions because things were not quite making sense. And in the end, he opted for atheism, but he continued to pursue religious studies, eventually became an ordained Unitarian Universalist minister, and he continues to practice Zen Buddhism. And again, you can hear all of that in episode number 124. So Doug, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Thrilled to be back for a third time. Two more and I'm an ace.
Oh, there'll be more than two more. Trust me. So, and while we're on introductions, I also feel that I need to introduce Ayaan. I mean, everybody knows Richard Dawkins. There's no introduction needed there. But Ayaan was a relatively new name to me. And I think there may be listeners who have never heard of this Ayaan Hirsi Ali. So again, in just a very quick thumbnail sketch, I'll say that she's a Somali immigrant to the Netherlands. She was Muslim while she was there, but she had to leave. She was very critical of many of her Muslim comrades, especially the ones who were very much into jihadist terrorism. So she needed to leave. She was a vocal opponent to that. And in the end, she renounced Islam entirely. She became a very vocal critic of Islam in particular and religion in general. And she gained a reputation for being one of the newest members of the New Atheists. Remember the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse? Well, she was now a new one. And she wrote a best-selling book, Infidel, that described the story. But what really hit the news was roughly a year ago, a little bit more recently than a year ago, she announced that she had converted to Christianity. Doug, is there anything more that we need to say about Ayaan?
I had actually heard about her and had read her book, Infidel, years ago. So it was not, she was not new to me. Her conversion was quite a shock. But she was fairly well known, at least in my circles. But no, I think you've covered it pretty well.
Okay. Well, then why don't you give us a quick synopsis of the video in particular?
Well, what people would not necessarily know from the introduction, but you will know if you watch the video, is that after a lot of exposure, not to mention death threats for her stand. In fact, I guess there is one thing I would add. She helped to make a movie called Submission, along with a man named Theo Van Gogh. He was murdered for this. This was about the oppression of women under fundamentalist Islamic law. So when you hear her talk with great anger about Islam, understand that her life has been threatened and a man she worked with was murdered by an Islamic terrorist. As to the video itself, she has wrestled with depression, anxiety, self-loathing, and a therapist suggested that maybe it has something to do with spiritual bankruptcy. And so what I got out of this was a woman who has wrestled with a lot of demons and had a lot of horrible things happen to her. And she found within her version of Christianity, and I can't emphasize that enough, because when you hear the two of them talk about Christianity, it's like they're talking about two different religions completely, which is what struck me watching it, that surely you two understand that the other person is experiencing something radically different than what you're talking about. And they must, but it just doesn't come through as much as I would have liked. But I wouldn't call it a debate. I would call it a fairly civil discourse. They've been friends. She calls him a mentor even. And so if you're expecting two people just trying to go at each other, I didn't see that, even though if you watch thumbnail sketches on YouTube, it's just like Richard Dawkins slams her for her views or horrible things like that. It was a civil, caring discussion, even though Dawkins totally disagrees with her conclusions. I didn't get the feeling that it was personal attacks in any way.
Right.
She says that Christianity is obsessed with love. He says it's obsessed with sin, things like that. They discuss a void within humanity that people need to fill with something. And she found Christianity, as she sees it, to be something that gave her a zest for life again, something to make life worth living, to get over all these obstacles that she's wrestling with. They discuss the role of faith and whether faith is worthwhile or not, and what it does. But as Luke already said, you need to watch it first. So if you haven't watched it yet, stop now, go back and watch it.
Exactly, right. And I'd agree with you. It is not a debate. It's billed as a debate with the title The God Debate, and it's neither a debate nor is it really about God. It's about worldviews, and I'll mention that in a second. We're not going to go through the conversation line by line or point by point. There's just too much in there. Our own conversation will just meander all over the place, and we'll end up with a two-hour long or three-hour long episode anyway. So what we're going to do is extract some main ideas, some larger themes, and then we'll share our own perspectives and ideas on those themes and what they said. And to help focus our conversation, I want us, the three of us and the listeners, to imagine a square divided into four. We're going to talk about a moral landscape, a floor space with four corners, and each corner of that space represents a different worldview. And during the course of their 60-minute conversation, Richard and Diane bounced around back and forth between those four different corners, those four different worldviews. They begin talking about Christianity itself in the one corner, and they dissect two different expressions of Christianity, but then they make comparisons between Christianity and atheism, which is the second corner in the square I'm drawing in my mind, and then comparisons between Christianity, atheism, and Islam, the third corner. And then finally, Ayam brings us to the fourth corner, a very dark and a scary corner that she talks about, talks quite a bit about, in fact, the moral vacuum and the mind virus of radical Islam and wokeism that fills the vacuum. That will be the fourth corner. So are both of you okay with that framework for our discussion?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. Now, then why don't we, just for the sake of time, let's just dive right in there. We'll start with the first corner, the one about Christianity in this moral landscape. Christianity, but two different expressions of Christianity. Those that endeavor to embrace all the moral and ideological aspects of Christian teaching, it's a conviction, a calling, or a constantly changing lifestyle, versus those that wear the label of Christianity, because that's the cultural context that one lives in. Here's what Richard had to say to Ayan after she explained in some detail how she came to Christian faith.
Ayan, that's a moving personal story, but
to call herself a Christian is a bit different. I mean, a Christian has to believe in something. And, I mean, you go to church now, and you listen to the vicar, and you kind of notice what a lot of nonsense he talks. I mean, do you really take it seriously that Jesus is the Son of God, Jesus rose from the dead, Jesus was born of a virgin, and that's part of Christianity. So you believe in some kind of higher power, which is comforting you, and you're obviously reacting from an Islamic past, and I know that from what you've written, that part of what you feel is that Christianity is a bulwark against Islam, which is a quite separate thing from what you've been now saying, but you stand by that. I mean, that's part of what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And I accept that, and I support that. That's why I've called you a political Christian. But from what you've just said, it sounds as though you're more than just a political Christian. I mean, it sounds as though you actually believe it.
Here's the host of the debate talking about Richard himself being a cultural Christian.
There is this bigger cultural, societal impact point that you've really been in the middle of, Richard. You came out as a cultural Christian.
I mean, I've been a cultural Christian all along, and I've never said anything else.
There was a lot of social media excitement recently that you had confirmed that you were a cultural Christian. This is, I suppose, the political Christianity point that Ayaan has also been making.
So guys, moral Christian versus political Christian versus cultural Christian, what do you think?
Well, for me, I could say that I found that nuance or distinction refreshing, because quite often in these discussions, and particularly debate style of things, although like you mentioned, this wasn't a debate, it was much more of a conversation, that nuance isn't there, right? We just talk about Christianity, and that's a big word that contains a lot of things. So I think that was good that they kind of broke it apart that way. I don't know what you thought, Doug.
Yeah, I have not dealt a lot with this notion of Christianity as a tool to oppose Islam. I know that exists out there, but at least in the world where I roam, it's far more, one, moral. How do you get saved? How do you get to heaven? How do you worship God properly? Or, at least where I live, very much ingrained with politics now, not because it's opposing Islam, which I emphasize comes up again and again in the video, but it does drive a move towards a theistic political landscape down here. I live in Tennessee in the South, and that's huge. And it's driving a lot of laws right now that are coming out of their interpretation of Christianity. And the leadership is hammering that home. So there are definitely different ways of looking at Christianity. Frankly, the way she looks at it is something to help her with the anxiety, depression, and fear that's crippling her, it sounds like.
Right.
And it's almost as though I don't care if it's true. I'm choosing to believe it's true because it is helping me.
Right.
And this is something that's very true amongst many different religions and amongst many, many people.
Right.
And that's true.
But Doug, your comment about, you said here at home, you're referring to your own Tennessee. That's what I would say is a perfect example of this cultural Christianity. There's this, you know, politically, you've got Republicans and Democrats, and Republicans are identified with evangelicals. And you look at the people who are Republican and evangelical, it's almost a perfect overlap, the Venn diagram. So it's a cultural identity. If you're Republican, you're Christian. If you're Christian, you're Republican, that kind of thing.
And that hasn't always been the case in America.
Right.
But it certainly is getting that way now.
Right.
But there are plenty of liberal Christians, and I know them, who are not Republicans. But the fundamentalists, the evangelicals, it's almost 100% near Republican.
Right.
Yeah. Just a distinction on this topic of moral Christianity. The way that I hear that anyway is the idea that you can take out all the supernatural aspects of Christianity, but it's still Jesus' moral teachings, and the moral teachings of Christianity still have great value, right? And so there's kind of a moralist understanding of Christianity, which came about very strongly in the 19th century, you know, with the rise of theologians like Friedrich Schleiermacher in Germany and so on, where the kind of the more liberal approach to Christianity. That's how I read that anyway, from what Dawkins was saying.
Is it fair to say that when we use this term, this label, liberal Christian, if you begin to cherry pick,
right,
if you start to say, well, okay, I call myself a Christian, but you know, when we come to miracles, I'm not so convinced, or I don't know what's going to happen in the afterlife. And then fundamentalist, evangelical, you might say, but people who stick to the Bible or the dogma of Christianity, you have to believe all the different tenets of Christianity or you're not a Christian. And then people might label you as not a Christian, even though you're trying to follow Christian values.
Yeah, certainly fundamentalists have a pretty stark dividing line. You know, if you're on this side, you're in. If you're on this side, you're out. And that includes a lot of those dogmatic kind of issues you're referring to. Yeah.
So maybe before we get too far into that, I think Doug's itching to say something. But before we get too far into that, let's hear very briefly what Richard and Ayan had to say about this whole idea of cherry picking Christian tenets.
Islam is a nasty religion. I think we agree about that. But Christianity is not all that nice either. And when you think about Christianity, Christianity is obsessed with sin. St. Augustine said that we all inherit the sin of Adam. Well, of course he didn't exist, but so we inherit original sin. Hmm. Original sin came down in the semen. Jesus was not conceived with semen, that's why he's clear of sin. His mother Mary had to be clear of sin as well, so she had to have an immaculate conception. This is all obvious nonsense. This is all theological bullshit. And the idea that humanity is born in sin and has to be cured of sin by Jesus being crucified, Jesus being punished for all our sins. And that is a morally very unpleasant idea. I'm sure you must agree about that.
I find that Christianity is actually obsessed with love, and that the figure, the teachings of... the teaching of Christ, as I see it, and again, I'm a brand new Christian, but what I'm finding out, which is the opposite of growing up as a Muslim, the message of Islam, but the message of Christianity I get is that it's a message of love, it's a message of redemption, and it's a story of renewal and rebirth. And so Jesus dying and rising again, for me, symbolizes that story. And in a small way, I felt like I had died and I was reborn. And that story of redemption and rebirth, I think, makes Christianity actually a very, very powerful story for the human condition and human existence and the pain of suffering, but also our internal, the recognition of what you call sin, but perhaps the character defects that both good and evil are there, but that both good and evil are in us. I think those teachings in Christianity are far more powerful and have led to, I think, the flourishing of Western civilization.
The Old Testament is a very, very nasty book indeed. And the New Testament, on the face of it, is better. But the aspect of it which I mentioned before, the idea of God couldn't think of a better way to forgive the sins of humanity than to have his son crucified. That is a disgusting idea.
God gave us... So the fact that I have faith and I choose to have faith because of what I've experienced is just as real for me as it is for the millions of people who believe. But for me, what is even more real is the story itself and the wisdom in that story, the morality that has come out, that has evolved out of that story, the internal debates of millennia long and everything that we inherited from it. It's just too casual to cast that aside. And when we've done it, I think we have caused ourselves a great deal of damage.
So are we allowed to cherry pick the theological elements of our Christianity? I know I do. And Doug, you've called me to task on that several times.
I think, and then for the audience, it's important to understand, we had an hour-long chat as a pre-briefing to figure out how we were going to approach this. And we talked about this at greater length. And that was a wonderful discussion, by the way. I think that people really do make Jesus in their image. And I'm not saying that they're saying that he's mythological. I'm saying they definitely find the things that Jesus said that resonate with them.
Yeah.
And those become the things that Jesus is to them. And the other things are forgotten or maybe not even realized.
Mm.
Jesus was a very complex person. Bart Ehrman often will say that he was essentially a man who thought of himself as the Messiah. Turned out he wasn't, and probably believed right up till the end that God was going to save him from death on the cross because he was the chosen one. And then it didn't play out quite that way. And so he's a failed Messiah, and he didn't come to die, but he was murdered by the Romans because they feared he was leading an insurrection, and crucifixion is, you know, how you punished people for daring to oppose Roman rule. But most people, if you talk to them about Jesus, they don't view Jesus in that way at all. They don't view him as a failed Messiah or as someone who could make mistakes. I think Jesus had some good moral teachings and some strange teachings. And when I bring it up, people like Luke and Scott will disagree with me and point out that you could interpret it differently. Yeah, you can. Absolutely.
And one way that I do interpret that is when Jesus was speaking, he was a Jew. He was speaking as a Jew. He saw himself as a Messiah for the Jews, and he said a lot of things that were very Jewish. And then later, Paul did change things. He did. It's undeniable that Paul changed things. And then the Christian church took off. And the Christian church has massively changed the things that Jesus taught. Even the fundamental meaning of the word, the gospel, the euangelion, it's been changed dramatically. Scott, you're leaning in.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot has been said there. And there's a lot of things that could be said. But just hone in on a couple things. I agree, Doug, with most of what you said, that we do create a Jesus in our own image. I think we create a God in our own image as well. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of interesting, you know, in the Hebrew tradition, there is such a strong emphasis on idolatry, right? And against idolatry. And that's kind of essentially what idolatry is. It's kind of creating things in our own image. So the issue of Jesus being a failed Messiah is a really interesting one. N.T. Wright has done a lot of interesting work in that area. And I agree with you. It is true that certainly in the sense of what people expected of a Messiah, was a dead Messiah is not a Messiah, right? And I agree with you as well. It may very well be. I mean, when I think of Jesus' last statement on the cross, you know, he's quoting, "But my God, why have you forsaken me?" I think to myself, is that a moment where he's really feeling that, wow, this did not work out the way I thought it was going, you know, this, you know, and of course you have the agony in the garden as well, where he's struggling with that. That I think I don't have any issue with that. I think that as a human being, that's very likely the case. And yet there are other things in the Gospels that do seem to indicate that he had some sense of, you know, so it's a little hard to completely unwind that. But this is, to me, where the resurrection comes into things. Without the resurrection, he's just another failed Messiah, right? So you could argue that that was invented for that very reason, because we can't have a dead Messiah, so Jesus must have risen. Nobody can deny that's a possibility. But it's also a possibility, I guess, in my mind, that something did happen to convince these people that he wasn't a failed Messiah. And that's a difficult thing to explain.
I just wanted to clarify a little bit, since I'm quoting Bart Ehrman. The other thing he points out, which I think explains so many things Jesus said that I've, even in my fundamentalist days, it would make me scratch my head, is that he was also an apocalyptic teacher. He believed the end was very near, and that explains a lot of things like, sell everything and follow me, and don't worry about tomorrow, and that just really makes sense to me. And I feel sorry in a way for Jesus, because he's been turned in. I think he's been turned into many things that he's not and never even purported to be, including, as Richard Dawkins says in the video, isn't the notion that Jesus had to be crucified so that God could forgive us, isn't that barbaric or disgusting? I think he said disgusting. And, you know, I believe that. Any church, no matter how liberal, no matter how loving, that thinks God can't forgive us unless the blood of the innocent is shed, I would find that appalling. And I used to believe it.
Yeah.
I believed it fervently.
We did an episode back around Easter, I seem to remember, where I talked about that, the need for Jesus mm-hmm. to die and how repulsive that is, that God needed blood to spill.
Season 4, episode 112.
And I drew an analogy with Braveheart, the movie. William of Wallace, Mel Gibson's character, who he realized he had taken the movement, the resistance against the British, as far as he could as an individual. He was leading the army. He took it as far as he could, and he realized in dying and being tortured and dying, he would light a fire under his followers, and they would be the ones who would carry the movement to completion. And that's one way I could see this here as well. Jesus was realizing he's not going to overcome the Roman Empire, not that he had a military objective. He's not the one who's going to change hearts. It's going to be the people that follow. And that's where I see the resurrection of Christ in the body. The church is the body, and that's the resurrection of Christ. And he lit a fire under these people they were completely different people after this event, right? So,
well, I would just say that the issue of the atonement and the things you're talking about, you know, the God need to have the shedding of blood to forgive and things like, are very much up for grabs amongst Christian theologians. So I don't think that they're necessarily, they're very popular views. And I, Doug, I know from where you live in particular, that's a very ingrained view. And it's a very ingrained view within mm-hmm. a lot of evangelicalism. However, I would only say that it's not the only view. And there are other ways of looking at the atonement than that particular way. Particularly, I think in the recent years, the idea of Jesus as Christus Victor, you know, the idea that in on the cross, he's, in a sense, it's not so much that God's punishing him on our behalf. It's more that he is facing the worst man can throw at him and overcoming it. There's a victory aspect to this. That's a view that's being explored quite a bit these days. So I guess I would just say that I think the details of what's going on there are very much, you know, open for discussion. And I don't think Christianity itself hinges on that one particular understanding of the atonement. Now, Richard Dawkins wants it to, because it's a very good talking point, right? It's a very good, I would call it a bit of a straw man. And I personally, this is an issue I have with Dawkins, that he wants Christianity to be something that he can pretty much destroy. and I see him doing that with her. I don't know about you guys. I don't think, Doug, you felt the same way, but go ahead.
Well, if you consider, first of all, the largest version of Christianity in the world is Roman Catholicism.
Right.
And the largest Protestant denomination is Southern Baptist.
Right.
Both of those totally believe that the blood of Jesus was necessary to forgive us for our sins.
That's true.
So I would take exception to calling it a straw man.
Okay.
It is certainly not all of Christianity. And anytime I talk about Christianity, I am fully aware of the incredible variety of right. Christians.
Right.
But if you're going to go by sheer numbers, he's not making a straw man.
No, well, not in, well, I just mean in this sense that he has this idea, which is repugnant to people, and you hear this a lot, that God is like the cosmic child abuser, you know, that basically, you know, he punishes his son, and is that, which is a, you know, obviously an odious thing. But I don't believe the church in Catholicism or in Protestantism has ever looked at it that way, right? You can say the blood of Christ is necessary, but what do you mean by that? It can be very different than the idea of God being, you know, a cosmic child abuser or
well, no one's calling it the Catholics, the Baptists, they don't call him a child abuser.
No, they don't. They don't. But
they do acknowledge that the blood of the innocent is necessary. And the Old Testament is filled with animal sacrifice. And Jesus becomes the ultimate sacrifice. Noah, almost everyone is killed after Noah's flood. And what's the first thing he does getting off the ark? He kills animals, sacrifices animals. It goes throughout the Old Testament.
Yeah.
And John is the last gospel. He starts laying everything out the most as though Jesus is this sacrifice for our sins.
Right.
Okay. We may come back to this at the end of the episode, but we have three more corners of this room to explore. So,
right.
Right.
Yeah. And this was all generated by, do we cherry pick?
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Okay.
And boy, did we go down a rabbit hole.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I mean, cherry picking, I mean, that's an issue for sure. But it's almost impossible not to some extent, right? No,
right.
In any field of study, you know, you're going to cherry pick.
I was going to say Christian denominations all through history.
Oh, yeah.
That's exactly what they're doing. That is what they're doing.
Right. It is.
So, okay. So let's now move to that other corner of the moral landscape that I described, atheism. And we'll begin with something that Richard said to Ian, and then Doug, you can start us off.
What I do want to say is this. Faith offers you something, obviously. That's very, very, very clear. But it doesn't make it true. It doesn't make the existence claims of Christianity true. There is a difference from saying that being in a certain psychological place is consoling and comforting and offers you a meaningful life and gives you a purpose in life, all those things, which are wonderful. And I have them too. They're a bit different, but I too have a purpose in life. I have a meaning in life. But just simply because something gives you a meaning and a purpose in life, it doesn't make the existential claims true. And Christianity, like any other religion, makes claims about the world, about the universe, which are either true or not true. And I may be wrong and you may be right. They may be true. But the mere fact that they're comforting doesn't make them true. That's an important point.
But I agree with you on that point. The mere fact that they are comforting doesn't make them true. But the hypothesis that there is something rather than nothing is something you can't disprove as much as I can't prove materially.
Yes.
Jesus. And now we have, you know, the range of human suffering where, as an atheist, you don't really offer an answer, you don't offer a prescription for this is a way of life, this is the path to happiness, this is how you can deal with the challenges of existence. And atheism is an attitude. It basically says, as of now, there is no evidence to show that God exists or that a higher power exists, full stop. And you figure the rest of it out. And it's very, very difficult to figure the rest of it out starting from scratch. And I think faith then gives meaning and purpose. And yes, if you're afraid of the dark and if you're afraid of whatever it is that's causing you anxiety, or whatever is causing you self-doubt, relationships between other human beings, I think Christianity does offer a recipe, and perhaps in my view, the best recipe for not only how to live with yourself and connect to the universe, but also how to connect with fellow human beings, and then bring about a civilization like this one.
Suppose it were true that atheism doesn't offer anything. It doesn't offer anything. So what? Why should it offer anything? Why should the universe offer you anything?
I think the question you ask now is very interesting. Why should atheism offer you anything? There is no reason why atheism should offer anything, but something else. Faith offers something valuable and tangible and
yes,
great. So why should atheism mock that and knock it down?
Is it not possible
to have this coexistence where there is a place for reason And there is a place for faith and for subjectivity. Just like we agree to have a separation between religion and politics, I think it is absolutely possible to have, and Christianity allows for that, a separation of science and the material world, the temporal world, versus the world of faith. And these things, when they complement each other, I think lead to a much more powerful outcome than when you, again, I find the differences between us a little cosmetic and a little artificial, because there are so many things I agree with that you are saying. It's just that the attitude that atheists take, that if you do not see the world the way they see it, and if you don't live according to reason, you must be an idiot. You must be unintelligent. You must be stupid.
No.
I think that is a bit that just smacks of...
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's not go there. I don't want to say that. What I do want to say is this.
Okay, we have some very interesting points being made here, and we're talking about finding meaning in life, and does atheism give you something that can instill meaning in your life? And Dawkins does a couple of things. First of all, he does mention that atheism doesn't have to give you meaning or purpose, but he does have meaning and purpose in his life. And that resonated with me, because of course that's where I am right now. Atheism is simply a statement that I have not found compelling evidence for there to be really it's a theistic God, a God who intervenes in our lives and cares about what's going on here. And I know that some will say atheists know there isn't a God. I disagree with that definition, but I don't get to make up definitions. And many people will argue, I'm not an atheist, I'm an agnostic, because I still think there could be something out there that I simply can't comprehend. So this whole argument about does atheist give you purpose? No, it in and of itself doesn't, nor is that what it's supposed to do. So I agree completely with Dawkins on that. And I also understand why Ali doesn't find it helpful. If she's wrestling with profound self-loathing, as she says, as well as depression and anxiety, she is looking for something that allows her to start over, to find forgiveness, to find unconditional love. And her, and I can't stress enough, her version of Christianity, and I'm not sure where she's going to church or who she's talking to, but that version of Christianity is giving her that. And why wouldn't she want that if she's having all these problems in her life? So that makes perfect sense. And atheism isn't going to give you that in and of itself. Now, oftentimes people will say that atheism leads to a materialistic view of the universe, that everything, consciousness, feelings, and all that has to be tied to our physical bodies and the physical processes of a materialistic universe. That is not true. Certainly there are atheists who believe that. Maybe most of them, I don't know. But I'm an atheist who's open to all sorts of weird concepts. There's a man named Bernardo Kastrup who's written several books on the idea of everything we experience, everything we are, is a connected network, part of a universal mind, for lack of a better description. I don't know if it's true. It doesn't drive my morality or behavior, but it is a way of looking at some complex questions like consciousness without falling back on a purely materialistic view or a theistic view. So the universe has many options for us. And as an atheist, I think you can find things of value and meaning and things that inspire you without having to believe in a theistic God. So I agree with Dawkins, but I understand what Ali's going through.
I like that. I use the term nuance too often, probably, but I do like that you're distinguishing between, in a sense, types of atheism, Doug, because I often have made that mistake, I admit, that to basically equate atheism with materialism. And let's face it, like you said, maybe the majority do, and I would think probably the majority do, typically atheists, that at least that I've known, and certainly the vocal ones like Dawkins and so on, are materialists. But you're saying that that's not a necessity. It doesn't have to right. fall. Right. And I think that's a fair point. I'm thinking of, there's an author, I can't think of him off the top of my head, but he's an atheist, but he wrote a very controversial book a few years ago.
Scott later told me this is Thomas Nagel and his book Mind and Cosmos.
Arguing against materialism, even though he's an atheist, he's not a materialist. And so, yeah, I think that's a really important thing to distinguish. I guess you might call yourself maybe a non-materialist atheist. Is that fair?
You could call me a mystic atheist.
Okay.
I think the universe is well beyond our imaginings. I think there's all sorts of exciting possibilities.
Sure.
And I think we do God a dishonor when we put that concept into our puny human boxes.
Right.
So if there is some kind of supreme being that's responsible for everything, and I had this conversation with my father recently, who is a fundamentalist who's wrestling with a lot of things, a lot of illnesses, watching his wife fade away to Alzheimer's.
Oh, boy.
I said, Dad, if I stand before God after I die, I can honestly say, I thought you were a much better person than I am. And I wouldn't do half the things Christians say you're going to do. I don't think you would do any of that stuff. And then, Dad, when you stand before God, or the fundamentalists do, God might look at you and say, really? You really thought I was going to torture people for all eternity? That's what you think of me.
Right.
And he laughed, and I think he agreed. I think his views are changing, faced with the harsh realities of many things. And we've been having some really good conversations lately that we never could have had before. And it's just, Dad, let God be better than you think God might be. And he's doing that now.
Right.
Well, it's too bad we didn't have time to get into one of the comments we were going to talk about under Christianity was the whole idea of cherry picking. We did kind of get into cherry picking, but we didn't talk about cherry picking. This would be an example of that.
Mm-hmm.
I have come to, and I know lots of Christians have come to the belief that this whole idea of God torturing people forever in hell, that is just not, we don't accept that. I don't accept that. I've moved on from that. Mm-hmm. I still call myself a Christian, but I just do not believe in this whole idea that God's going to torture people forever in hell.
Right.
So I don't know if that's comforting in any way for you, Doug.
Well, I've listened to all your episodes, Luke. I know where you're coming from.
Okay. So, well, if you know where I'm coming from, one question I was going to ask you then, Doug, what do you think of, here's where I'm at. I have questioned a lot of the tenets of Christianity. All my listeners, and you would be one of them, know that I've questioned a lot of the tenets of Christianity. But I still am compelled to think that there is the possibility of a higher being, a creative life force, a God, that sort of a thing. And it's a choice I make. It's a choice I make. And as a scientist, I work with proof. I will disprove things, or I will prove things, or at least increase the probability of accepting those things. If you're a scientist, you know what I mean by that, P less than 0.05. But here's my point. You can't prove that there is a God. You can't prove that there's not a God.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is a matter of choice. And I choose to believe that there's something bigger. And again, creative life force, a higher being, or God. But when I do that, when I say, yeah, I kind of think that there is a God, it does make a lot of other things make sense. It does make sense if I take the assumption that there is something bigger out there that has a purpose for us, has some expectations of us, and things just make more sense. What do you think of that?
If that makes more sense for you, I don't really have anything to say about it, because I can't tell other people how to think or what makes sense or what doesn't to them. And certainly having a God out there would explain some things we haven't figured out yet, for sure.
Right.
I still marvel at the intricacies of the human body. And consciousness is an amazing concept.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why I read books that are outside normal bounds of scientific thinking. You know, the idea of everything being connected and part of a cosmic mind answers some questions too. But I don't know if it's true, and I can't prove it's true, and I probably won't know it's true. But it also offers a possibility of conscious existence after death. Again, don't know that that's going to happen. And the fact that I would like to keep existing doesn't make it true and doesn't make me turn to it. So it would be, again, within the realm of possibility that there is a God from my perspective. so that that makes sense to you is perfectly understandable. Because, as you say, we're never going to prove it one way or the other. So that part of it isn't the issue. The part of it is when people say they know what Jesus said, they know what Jesus wanted to do. You know, these are all secondhand accounts written by people. Right. We don't know who they are. Names have been attributed to the Gospels. And I'm always the one to say, I don't know. So who knows what Jesus really said? We have traditions handed down, and you can't. So when someone says, well, Jesus loves the little children, how do you know? That sounds harsh, but really, how do you know? You know, I had a pastor friend who said to me, you know, I used to work in Appalachia in the poorest of poor areas. Mm. And you'd see children that, you know, didn't have enough food, lived in abusive homes, just struggling and suffering. How do you look them in the eye and say, Jesus loves you? He said, I couldn't do it. And she talks about humility, Ali does in this, about being humble about what we know. I think that's a really good thing. Mm-hmm. All of right. us should be really humble about what we claim to know, be it Christian or atheist. And the whole point that doesn't really come up much is the reason people like Dawkins are so violently opposed to it is because those values are being used to drive politics, to drive terrorism, to drive all sorts of things that affect people. And it's happening in America. We talked about this in our pre-meeting. Laws are being passed to take away many rights of women in the South pertaining to abortion and medical care that would have any chance of even accidentally causing an abortion. And so you can allow people to have faith, but when that faith becomes weaponized or politicized, then like Dawkins, you have to fight back against it. I think that's a fair way of assessing what he's doing. Just say, he's this angry old man who hates Christianity. Well, Christianity as a political force has done a lot of harm.
I get that sense too, Doug, that, you know, he's definitely reacting something, right? And and it's kind of interesting how, in one sense, because he's British and really British politics is not very driven by religion compared to what's happening in the US right now. So it's just kind of interesting that being British, he's as animated about it as maybe as he is. But, you know, one thing that comes up in this podcast all the time, and I think you're hitting on it, Doug, is this issue of certainty. As you were talking, I just always going on in my mind, I think, you know, the enemy is certainty. The enemy is not religion, it's certainty. Mm-hmm. Whether it's ideological certainty, whether it's scientific certainty, when we're so certain of things that we then believe that we have the right to force those things on other people, I think that becomes extremely problematic. And I think that's what Dawkins is reacting to, and I certainly do as well, right? And
yeah. No, I agree. And in our pre-meeting, we discussed if Christianity were open and allowing of all these different views without demanding any kind of conforming thought, it would be a wonderful thing. So preach it, brother.
Okay, guys, we do need to move on. We're going to talk about Islam as well, because it comes up in two different contexts in this debate, in this conversation. On the one hand, Ayan moved out of Islam and into atheism and then later into Christianity. And Richard has a lot to say, a lot of very negative things to say, actually, about Islam and about Christianity. And so Islam is the third corner of this moral landscape I've been referring to. But Islam is also represented in the fourth corner in Ayan's many references to the moral vacuum that was created when Western society sought to purge itself of religion. And that moral vacuum was filled by, as she puts it, the mind virus of radical Islam and wokeism. We'll talk about that later, but let's first stay here in the third corner. I'll play a few clips from the debate, comments that Richard and Ayan made about Islam, and then, Scott, you can take us after that.
They all, these Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, they have the same holy book. They believe in hell. They believe in a dictatorial God. They believe in so much that's similar. The problem with Islam is that it's 700 years out of date. And Christianity has moved on thank goodness, and mainly because most Christians don't actually believe it anymore. I mean, they don't take it seriously. The problem with Islam is that they take it seriously. They believe in their religion. They actually will fight to the death for their religion in the way that crusaders used to. And thank goodness they no longer do. Christianity has grown up, has grown out of that.
But first, I really do want to object, Freddie, to Richard, the statement you made about the holy books of Christianity and Islam being the same is absolutely untrue. And in fact, maybe a follow-up to this discussion would be to actually read these books to see what's in them and how different they are. And another mega, mega difference is the characters of Jesus and the characters of Muhammad are absolutely radically different.
I totally agree with that.
But that is why the holy books are not the same. The story is absolutely not the same. They are different. And yes, each one of them makes a claim to being an Abrahamic religion. And there I do have to do a little bit of reading up on Abraham. I have to do a little bit of reading on the Old Testament. But as far as I can tell now, from where I am in the New Testament, it couldn't be more different from the Quran.
Well, okay.
When I realized the damage that I was doing, and I was doing a great deal of damage by equating Islam with Christianity. First of all, it is false. We were talking about truth and falsehood. And not all religions are the same. Religions are different because they come out of different cultures and grow out of different contexts. So Christianity is not the same as Islam, and I'm guilty of having said, well, all faith, all perceptions of God are the same and they're equally damaging. So I come back from that, and I also have come to regret the damage that I've done, and I want to make my friends like Richard and Sam Harris and Daniel Dennett and all the others, I want you to see what I see. And what I see is where the flourishing of Western civilization compared to, say, growing up as a Muslim when I was taught that really the only way for you to be faithful is to fear, naked fear, and to have these sets of obligations which you basically obey. And that was very much about power. It was centered around hellfire and all of these other things. And so Christianity, as I experienced, I'll give you an example. When I was an atheist and I was going all over both the United States and all over Europe mocking Christians, making fun of them, making fun of faith, as you're doing now, dear Richard, I was walking with 6 to 7 men at any given time protecting me armed from things that I said that were offensive to Muslims, or Muslims thought were offensive to them. Christians were writing me letters saying, you know, we're going to pray for you, you're misguided. And I think that alone defines for me the distinction between Christianity in general, mainstream Christianity, and mainstream Islam.
Well, I must say, I've never met a vicar that I didn't like. I mean, they're always very, very nice people.
Yeah, the issue of equating Christianity and Islam, as I've mentioned to our listeners before, I have a touch point with Islam because my daughter is Muslim, converted a number of years ago. And so that has exposed me to the world of Islam, a world I was not very familiar with. And one thing that I think is really important to come out of the discussion is that Islam, like Christianity, is massive, right? There are many different types of Islam and many different traditions within Islam, and in some ways even paralleling traditions within Christianity. So I think it's really important to distinguish radical Islam and the type of Islam that would force itself on people and enforce things like Sharia law and stuff, which is really, I think, her main background, right? That's where she's coming from. Totally understandable, especially given her lived experience of these things. Yeah, I guess I think a little bit like an ex-smoker, right? You know, once you are free from smoking, then you want to tell everybody else to get free. You know, there is that, I think, aspect. But I do also agree with her that there are very significant differences, obviously, too, between even non-radical Islam and Christianity, and to equate them would definitely be a mistake. So
I have experience with Islam because I was in the Air Force and deployed to Afghanistan. Afghanistan was a, by name, Islamic Republic. And if you want to go around and look at how religions actually impact societies, that would be a very black eye for Islam, because that's a country that's just suffered horribly. And the level of corruption is almost comically obvious. If, for instance, I had one of the interpreter's house had been broken into and they tried to get the police to investigate it, the very first thing you have to do is pay a bribe to even get them to come to your house. And bribery is just a way of life there. Now, in America, we're just much more sophisticated about our corruption. But I could at least expect a police officer to show up at my house if it had been broken into, and they might actually do something about it, and I wouldn't have to pay a bribe. So Islam is not, again, a monolithic entity, and people will make of it what they will, just as they will with other religions. But my exposure to an Islamic country was not very favorable, as you might imagine. And the stories I heard were heartbreaking. And one of the things that we saw every day as we rolled out of our base was groups of girls wearing black with white headscarves walking to school, which was something they weren't even allowed to do under the Taliban, which are one of the most extreme forms of Islam. So when these two rail against Islam, it's not without warrant. But again, it's not all Islam, but there is a certainly very harmful, horrible version of it out there that's causing a great deal of suffering. But this is also true of Christianity throughout history. So yeah, you know, I'm not setting one against the
other. That was an interesting point that Richard made. He was talking about how Christianity did do many things, but they grew out of it. They had the Reformation was one stage in it, but they grew out of, you know, this, well, many of the things that we're talking about, the Inquisitions and the tortures and what have you. And he's saying it's about time that Islam also grows out of it. They're 700 years behind, is what Richard said.
Yeah, that's often said, you know, that they're like, you know, 700 years behind. There's a certain hubris in saying that, as if we're so advanced. But I can see where people are coming from.
I think it is an advancement to move beyond torturing to
simply.
I'm not trying to be funny. No. There is an advance there.
the question that comes up all the time, and I don't know, I kind of wonder, I think it's maybe not a valid question in a way, or not answerable, is this inherent to Islam or not? So in other words, if you really follow Islam, you end up with Sharia and some of the things that we, right? Or is that an aberration that will eventually be overcome? In Christianity, I think you can make a pretty good argument that based on Jesus' teachings that we're fairly certain about, a lot of the things that have happened in Christian history are clearly against those things, right? That they were an aberration, and therefore Christianity could develop and progress and so on. Is that also true in Islam? I can't answer that question, but that's certainly an important question.
And I think it is an aberration. At the risk of repeating myself and you, Scott, I think it is inherent in Islam. There are texts that they will use to justify some of these things, whereas others amongst them will say, no, we're pushing it too far. Just like in the Old Testament, there are texts that justify, you know, what to do about a slave captured in war, what to do with a kid who beaks off at their parents, what to do with, you know, various people caught in various acts of sexual impropriety according to their laws. So they are there in the text, and there was a time when those were enforced. And then we went, okay, I don't think we're doing the right thing here. We're not interpreting this correctly. Yeah. So again, at the risk of repeating myself, that's what did happen for Christians 700 years before. What's now seems to be happening amongst Muslims as well.
There are glimpses of it, but from my experience of conservative Islam, at least, but maybe that's true of any conservative group, the idea of reformation, the idea of change, is just anathema, because for them, the Quran you know, was dictated to Muhammad, and not one thing can be questioned or changed. Now, that's conservatives, you know.
Yeah, but on that point, isn't that the same as fundamentalist Christians?
It is.
So you can't change. We cannot change. The words are the words.
It is. It is. You're right. So it's a question of whether there will rise up within Islamic world, you know, non-fundamentalists, right? And I think there are glimpses of that, but not a lot. You know, like where you do see that most, I think, is in the West. You know, you do see that in the U.S. You'll see a lot more moderate, from what I've experienced, at least, a lot more moderate than in the Middle East, because that's where Islam is in charge in a lot of countries. Like, it's interesting to me, every Iranian woman that I have met, and that's not a lot, but a few, that I have told that my daughter converted to Islam, you should see the look of horror on their face. And a number of them say to me, she needs to come to Iran if she thinks Islam is the way to go. Now, obviously, that's a very poor sample. These are people who obviously left Iran, you know, for those reasons. But it is kind of interesting that perspective of living in an Islamic republic versus Islam only as a religion. They're very different things.
The only other comment I would add, we talked briefly about hell earlier from the Christian perspective. If you read the Quran, you will find many more references to hell, much more graphic, much more crystal clear, that it is a literal place of torture. So hell is very real in Islam. Christianity, you can take the verses that reference it and try to wrestle with them, make them say something else. Don't think you can really do that with the ones in the Quran. They're very, very clear. So
Pretty tough,
a reality in that religion.
Okay, for the sake of time, let's now step into that fourth corner. This is that moral vacuum. The one that Ayan said was that she saw being created when Western society sought to purge itself of religion, much like China did in its Cultural Revolution of the 1960s, and Russia did a few decades before that, and France did in its own revolution in the late 18th century, and we know how destructive those periods in history were. Ayan was very alarmist about what is now filling that moral vacuum. I'll let you and the listeners hear it in her own words.
The way I would like to put it is, you have this amazing civilization, you have these amazing societies, and it is pretty frightening to see that the best and the brightest are converting to the mind virus of wokeism and the mind virus of Islamism, and that as atheists, no one even seems to have woken up to the idea. There is a condemnation of wokeism, which you do, which you condemn the woke and the mind virus of the woke, you condemn radical Islam. But I think, what do we then have to offer to these young people who are seeking something?
Rational secular humanism. Enlightenment values.
And I really mean this in a serious way. I look at those young people in their 20s, in their teens, in their 30s, and right now they're being offered these messages of moral frameworks that they're embracing that are cultish, that are based on fear, that are nihilistic, and that are dead end. And so if you say, I want to make my friends like Richard and Sam Harris and Daniel Dennett and all the others, I want you to see what I see. And what I see is where you have a moral vacuum, something is going to fill it. I want you to see that the teachings of Christianity, just like you said, if there is a competition between Team Christian and Team Islam, you would be on Team Christian. That what you value in Christianity is something that really is absolutely necessary to pass on to the next generation. And we have failed the next generation by taking away from them that moral framework and telling them it's nonsense and false, but also not protecting them then from the external forces that come in for their hearts, their minds, and their souls.
I think you're wrong to say.
And the vector for this virulent anti-Semitism is Islam, it's radical Islam. On every university, there is a Muslim student association. There are Islamic centers, there are mosques, there are websites. and they propagate, and sometimes in the most sinister ways, their faith and their antipathies and the antipathy that radical Islamists hold against Jews have had, like, they're running amok in our universities and our schools. So if from one day to the next, what we are seeing is the investment that radical Muslims made here on our soil, those young people completely brainwashed into coming out and blaming the victim, draping themselves in kefirs, shouting genocidal slogans and chants on our campuses, and thinking that they are replicating 1968 and see themselves as anti-war patrons. There is something that is going on. There is the mind virus of wokeism. There is the mind virus of radical Islam. And atheism is not the answer. I cannot go with all conscience to these young people and say there is nothing to believe in. Because the more we say there is nothing to believe in, there is nothing, then someone else comes and fills that nothing with something. And I don't like what I'm seeing.
Are you angry?
So the people who are in charge of universities, people who are in charge of educating and developing young minds, are looking on and thinking, what the heck is going on here? And that is not the right attitude. And it never has been the right attitude. There's a great deal of denial. Yes, there's a clash of civilization. And this clash of civilizations has been going on at least since 1989. And the attitude of Western leaders, political leaders, academic leaders, media leaders, has been to hide in denial. It's been to deny it. And the more you deny it, the more those adversaries who are clashing with us benefit from it. And right now, I don't think atheist humanism is offering any answers. I challenge you to come up with an elaborate message to fight these people.
What is your message?
So Ayan sees a toxic mixture of radical Islam and wokeism, filling that vacuum. Before the three of us get too far in our dissection of what she said, let's define wokeism, what people might think the word means, and what I think how Ayan means the term. I understand that term can mean a lot of different things to different people. It certainly is a term that gets overused and I think misused in certain political corners of the U.S., and it's usually associated with too much emotion, too much loud and angry protest, and much of that is not very helpful. One fairly bland but reasonably accurate dictionary definition of wokeism is this. It's the promotion of liberal, progressive ideology and policy as an expression of sensitivity to systemic injustices and prejudices. So Christians can be woke, but so can atheists. Republicans and Democrats can both be woke. Queer people and straight, black people and white, all of these and many other ways that you might want to pigeonhole people, all of them can be woke. But when Ayan uses this term, the context of what she says tells me that she's usually, in her mind, she's picturing students on university campuses protesting loudly over a variety of social issues. We've seen it on the news, the various issues that they're protesting over. So Scott and Doug, do you agree on my definition, the one I got from the online dictionary, and also the one how maybe she means it when she talks about this wokeism?
I would say that your definition was accurate until it became a political weapon.
Right.
A couple of years ago, at least in the U.S. And I will add that being a Unitarian Universalist minister, Unitarian Universalists would embrace the term woke. If there was a church of wokeness, it would be Unitarian Universalists. I've also seen that wokeism, for lack of a better word, can be extreme to the point where it shuts down alternative discussions and almost becomes radicalized to the point where there is only one way to think on these issues. In fact, that is happening amongst those who are politically progressive, who emphasize social justice issues, who are fully willing to understand the hardships that have been caused to minorities in the past in this country, to women, the horrific things done in our history. If you're willing to honestly acknowledge all those things, it doesn't mean you hate America, but some people have got to the point where they hate America. Republicans now use it as a widespread term to attack any Democrat, any liberal, for any reason. They're just called woke without even knowing what the word means. In fact, there's a little game newscasters like to do down here is go to Trump rallies, talk to people and say, so what do you think woke means? And then they just sort of stare blankly, at least the ones that the clips that they show us.
Right. Yeah.
A lot of people, to them, it's just you're the devil worshiping Democrats who eat babies and drink their blood and you're woke. It's all the same thing.
It's a classic case of, you know, a dictionary definition, but then words change, right? They morph. And exactly what Doug is, I agree with what you're saying, Doug, that it has become weaponized. But I will say this, not only weaponized by the right, not only weaponized by the Republicans, because people like Bill Maher on the left also have become, you know, very, very anti-quote woke. You know, they also have, they use the word in a very disparaging. It seems to have come to mean the extreme left. It seems to be kind of how it has kind of come out. That's certainly how a guy like Bill Maher would, I think, view it. That basically it's illiberal, actually. It's not a liberal, because on the extreme, right. Yeah. Because on the extreme, just like we were talking about before, it's that certainty thing again, right? Mm-hmm. At the extreme, there are people who feel that they are, quote, woke, and want to shove that down everybody else's throat, you know, their particular version of what that is. And that's not liberal, you know.
So then that's how we're seeing this term and how Americans are seeing this term. But how about Ayan? She's the one who's brought this up in this conversation. She talks about, we talked about the four corners, the three rooms, the three corners of the room, Christianity, Islam, and atheism. And now we're talking about what happened when you just remove all religion. That's what the Western society seems to be doing, is removing religion, creating a moral vacuum. And then she talks about that vacuum being filled by radical Islam and wokeism. Is she going too far on that? What do you think?
I think there's a lot of truth in that. Moral vacuums have to be filled. We have to have some way to live, right? And, you know, I agree with what Doug said earlier, what Dawkins says, that atheism is not required to give us a way of life. And it isn't, because atheism is a philosophy. It's a philosophical statement. It's not a statement of how one should live their life. However, we do need to understand, we do need to exist as a society. And therefore, we have to have some understanding of moral values and how we should behave and so on. And I think right now, with the rise of secularism in the West, there is a real vacuum created there. Some would say that's great, because now we have to figure this out. You know, we have to create our own meaning and so on. Okay. But it creates a lot of chaos, right? And a lot of competing opinions. And I think she's right in seeing that.
And the irony that I see is that these are completely different ideologies. When you talk about radical Islam and wokeism, at least how it's being played out on campuses, university campuses in the U.S. and Canada, I saw it. I've been to a couple convocations, and I've seen this as the students promenade across the stage. I've seen this combination of there's an Islamic element, and there is very much this wokist element. And you look at the encampments on the campuses. Flags, Palestinian flags, Muslim Islamic flags, and then all these a variety of flags and posters, which I'll put under the category of wokeism. I think you know what I mean. And they're completely different ideologies. They just couldn't be further apart. How can you even imagine a radical Islamist defending the values that the woke crowd hold and defend? Things like non-binary genderism and non-binary sexuality, the gender creative and the gender fluid, equal rights for women, a postmodern view of truth and absolutes. I could go on, but you have to be able to see that those two groups have completely different worldviews, and somehow they think they're united.
Well, I think they're united in that one area of social justice, right? That's where I think the touch point is, that the woke people see what's going on in the Middle East, and they're incensed by it, right? Their sense of justice. And that's where they're identifying, because you're absolutely right. There's, you know, if you took those people and plunked them into an Islamic country, they'd be arrested immediately. You know,
arrested. They would be, if they're chanting their protests and waving their flags, they would be taken to the nearest tall building and thrown off the edge.
Yeah,
within a minute. I'm not trying to be funny. It's serious.
No, you're right.
And yet
you're
they right. think they're comrades in arms. It's just
Yeah.
comical.
It is in a certain way. Yeah.
See, I'll take a dissenting point of view here to some degree. I haven't gone out and talked to the people in these groups, so I don't know. But again, we discussed this in our pre-meeting also. You can be woke, wildly left-wing to the extreme, and you can be out there simply saying, stop killing innocent people,
right,
without saying, we think Islam is great. Right. I don't think most LGBT people think that Islam is great,
right,
or that they want to become Muslims. They understand what's happening. But what they're doing right now, maybe, is simply protesting the insane amount of death in Palestine, in Gaza. And I am not speaking for them. I don't know. There is, again, as a Unitarian Universalist, having been around many people who would be derisively called social justice warriors or woke, I do know that there is a kind-heartedness within them that they want to find the best in all the different religions. They don't want to be like Sam Harris or Richard Dawkins or even I am, who say, hey, there's a pernicious streak in this and it's a danger and you need to be aware of it. They would say, well, that's a small number. And, you know, most Muslims are peace loving. And that's probably true, too. You know, what I saw in Afghanistan was a lot of people just trying to make ends meet.
Sure.
Trying to get through the next day, hoping they had enough electricity that night. And I kid you not, to watch an Indian soap opera that they loved. That was, when you're in a war-torn nation that barely has a functioning infrastructure, they don't care about killing Americans or LGBT people or throwing, most of them wouldn't throw people off the buildings. You know, they're just not like that. It's the extremists who have the power, and the power was great to them. And then somehow they think they're doing God's will by being horrific.
Right.
So I'm sure there's wildly extreme woke people out there who are dangerous too. But again, let's assume many of them really just see all the killing and are horrified by it.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah.
So for the sake of time, then, it's unfortunate. There's a lot of things we can discuss in this topic, in this corner of the room, but also all four of the corners that we've been in today. But we do not have a lot of time. So maybe a quick question. Do you think that conversation, which was labeled as a debate, and I don't think it was a debate, but was the conversation useful? Was it productive? Maybe make some final comments on that conversation between Richard and Ayan.
Well, I would say that I was glad I watched it. I found some useful insights. It was very sad to hear how she had had a rough life. I was glad to see that she found something that helped her find a reason to go on. It's one of those things that I can't relate to because I haven't wrestled with it. I've never been diagnosed with depression or had to take antidepressants. I've never felt overwhelming anxiety. And so I've been blessed in that sense. And I am fully sympathetic to how people try to find things that give their life meaning or answers or whatever, because I've done that my whole life too. So I would never mock someone like her for her decision. And I found it interesting how when Dawkins asked her various questions about what she believed and what she didn't believe, she was honest enough to say, I've chosen to believe this. I have chosen to believe this is important, that this will give me meaning, this will help me find my way.
And
we've all discussed, there's a lot of Christianity she hasn't experienced yet, and including the sides that are oppressive. But she's found a version that she thinks is obsessed with love, and that's great. If she's involved in some branch of Christianity where that is the feeling that she gets, that's wonderful. And, you know, who am I to criticize? I think it was a valuable discussion. I'm glad they have it available for us to see.
And I would concur with that. I found it refreshingly, especially with Richard Dawkins, because it's not often that you see kind of that side of him, kind of a, you know, a laid back and thoughtful discussion, you know, not trying to prove
and a even point. A soft side.
Yeah, soft side, not trying to have gotcha moments and things like that. I, I really appreciated that. And I think it was good for, to be honest, I think it was good for Richard, probably, for his persona or his brand, if you want to say, to have that. And it does come down at the end of the day, on all sides, you make a choice, right? And I guess, you know, that Kierkegaardian leap of faith, you know, and I do think she's on a journey. And I don't think this barely begun. And who knows where she's going to end up on that journey. I've seen a number of people. I remember Anne Rice a few years ago jumped onto the Christian bandwagon and was very vocal and wrote some books and so on. And now she doesn't call herself a Christian anymore, right? And that's mainly because of what she experienced amongst Christians, especially regarding their attitudes toward the LGBTQ community. So, you know, she's on a journey. But I think it's been very interesting to listen in on her journey.
And we'd love to also hear from you, our listener. Send in your comments to our private Facebook discussion group page, if you're a member, or at our WordPress home webpage, and share this with a friend or two. I'm positive you know people who have an opinion or two about the friction between Christianity, atheism, and Islam, and the students protesting on university campuses. But with that, thanks, guys. It was a long discussion, but I enjoyed it. And thanks, Doug, for coming on again.
Yeah, thanks, Doug.
Always a pleasure. Always willing to come anytime you need me, just ask.
Very good. Ciao, guys. Have a good weekend.
See you later, guys.
Bye.
Right, bye now. You've been listening to Recovering Evangelicals with your hosts, Luke Jansen and Scott Dyer. Send your comments and suggestions for new episodes to lukejjansen@gmail.com. Join our private discussion group on Facebook by searching for the Recovering Evangelicals podcast group. Look for the logo that you always see at your favorite podcast catcher and ask to be let in. Subscribe to lukejjansen.wordpress.com if you want to get advanced releases and group posts. Or browse through our archive for a full listing of all our previous episodes. And please help the podcast by sharing with a friend and leaving a review at your favorite podcast catcher.